Are viewers nerds?
No.
Yes, how dare you?
No, not us, right?
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin.
And I'm Matt Hogan.
On this week's show, we are talking all about used EVs and battery health with Scott Case, the CEO of Recurrent, which is a company that tracks battery health in used EVs. Plus, later on, we'll discuss VW's cheapest EV yet and GM's big Gemini announcement.
Let's get into it. So, Tim, let's start off with like the top line number. What's going on with used EV sales?
Yeah, so I think like in a bit, our conversation with Scott was really fun. We get into a lot about EV battery health and like what you need to know about that and what his company has learned over years of testing EVs and learning about how they retain range. We also wanted to just give a little backstory on the used EV market right now, because it's actually like the big bright spot in EVs, right, is used. New EV sales crashed after the end of the tax credit, sort of struggling to recover. Used EVs, completely different story, as we get into a bit in the episode, or in the interview, I should say. So last month, I spotted this, that Americans bought nearly 43,000 used EVs in March. This was according to Cox data, a new monthly record. That also makes for over 100,000 used EVs sold in the first quarter. And what struck me about that was like, you know, everybody expected, tax credit ends September 30th of last year. Everybody expected the market to collapse, which for new EVs, it like somewhat did.
Right.
And used had the same sort of pattern where like sales went up and up and up in the run up to the end of the tax credit because everybody wanted to claim that $4,000 tax credit for the used EVs. Sales dropped in the immediate aftermath, but then they bounced back pretty quickly. And then, like I said, last month, they're already higher than they were in the fall. During that whole frenzy, which is like, wow, like there, it just goes to show like the deals are great, as we'll talk about.
Yeah.
And there's just this amazing supply of off-lease EVs that's just contributing to this momentum that you don't quite have with new
EVs.
Yeah,
I think the used EV tax credit is such an interesting one too, because I don't think it ever reached the level of awareness that the $7,500 one did, partially because the $7,500 one like existed for a long time in different forms, whereas the used EV was only post IRA. It also had some income requirements that were tough. And then the big thing was it only applied to vehicles under $25,000, which at the time, you know, for most of its existence, that limited it pretty severely to things like Bolts, some of the early Model 3s, Leafs, those things. And it's such a shame that it's gone now, because everything is under 25. Although, of course, you know, how much of that is because the tax credit is no longer, you know, the used market is just much more pricing responsive than I think the new market is. There's not this huge, you know, machine that needs to unwind, you know, production capacity or whatever. You just price the car what it takes to get it off the lot. But they're flying off the lot. I mean, it's pretty amazing to see. We've seen a lot of data showing that not only are they selling a lot of them, but they're selling quickly. They're not sitting on lots for a super long time, which again is the opposite of how it was even 2 years ago. So consumers seem to be catching on that these are real deals.
Yeah. And it's completely different from, and I'll give a shout out to all the great feedback we got on our Q&A episode last week, especially. There were a lot of comments about me and owning an EV or not owning an EV. And I'll say like the deals that you're seeing now is so different from what it was when I was shopping and looking for cars in like 2023. It was exactly what you're saying. It was like, yeah, there was a tax credit, but by and large, you were looking at, you know, the cheap stuff, the like under $20,000 stuff was just like not that appealing.
Yeah.
It was either cheap or it was long range pretty much.
Right.
All the Ioniq 5s and EV6s and stuff were still like fairly new. They were like 2 years old, 1 year old. It's a totally different story now.
Well, and factor in the income cap there too. You have this thing where they're the low range EVs or things like the Bolt that are bad at fast charging. But because you're targeting consumers, I believe it was under $80,000, depending on whether you're married,
like that,
there's a couple other restrictions. You have this limitation of, well, now you're targeting people who are you know, lower earners than a new car buyer, which means they're less likely to have a single family home that they can easily install home charging at. And if they do have a single family home, they're less likely to, you know, want to put up the $2,000 to install the level two plug or whatever. So there's a lot of weird conflicting incentives that went in there. But ultimately it was just, I think it was a little too early because they're just, regardless, there just wasn't enough options. And you are not going to, there are tons of people that are going to be happy with the Bolts and the Leafs, and I think they're great cars. But there's a lot of people who show up on a lot and they say, hey, I want an SUV, and already everything's off the menu, right? And I think it would be awesome if that existed now, but it's cool to see that the market is correcting anyway. Like there's a lot of supply coming out. And notably, I mean, I think this is a record month, but I don't know about you. I doubt that this record will stand, just as this year we're seeing so many lease returns scheduled to come back. So many, especially I just think of how many aggressive 24-month lease deals I saw when I was shopping for my car in July of 2024. You know, my car is going to be going back on a lease. And, you know, one thing I always kind of point out is, like, if you're looking at 2-3-year-old off lease cars, you can basically choose anything that is available on the new market in meaningful volumes, right? Look, when you look at all of the top sellers, whether it's, you know, obviously the Model 3 and Model Y have been there forever on that list, but Kia EV6, Hyundai Ioniq 5, Volkswagen ID4, Chevy Equinox EV, Mustang Mach-E, you know, BMW i4, Polestar 2, even some expensive stuff, all of this stuff is under 25 or under 30. And that's just, I mean, that gets you nothing on the new car market and you know, only a few options on the new EV market. So there's just so much choice there. And notably, because these, you know, successive models, the next gen stuff isn't really here yet, a lot of what you can get on the used market is very, very similar to what's new. I mean, you look at an Ioniq 5, for instance, right? Like, yes, the versions that you're getting that are off lease, not going to have the Tesla style NACS port. They're not going to have the upgrades the 2025 model got, you know, a little more range, all that stuff. But fundamentally, it looks, feels, drives like the same car. And I think that's just, again, like there was such a push with the new car incentives to get you into new cars. And it's kind of interesting that when that tax credit disappeared and the new market starts collapsing, like it shouldn't surprise me that then you see the used market pick up, right? Because one of the things that was holding down the used market was, of course, that the deals were so good on the new market. You know, you couldn't compete with a crazy lease deal at the time when you're offering a, you know, 3-year-old car, which in 2023 was like maybe not a super competitive vehicle. If you're looking at 2020 models, you have like the Model 3 and everything else is like not the combo of 250 plus miles plus 150 kilowatt fast charging. You know, the basics that I think most people demand at this point. And so it's pretty cool to see all this stuff available for such a good price and with very little trade-off in terms of what you're missing from getting a new car.
Yeah. I mean, like now it's flipped, right? Like for the longest time, I think you'd see people, maybe even us saying this, I have like a person, I just like don't love the idea of leasing. Just like, even though I know it is a good idea, it can be a good idea, I'm still like, I kind of want to own something. But, you know, a lot of the experts were telling people, like leasing is the best way to buy an EV because you hedge against, improvements over time. You hedge against the depreciation. You get the tax credit. You get a great deal on it. And then a couple of years later, like there are going to be new models out and you can get something else. And the flip side of that is that that is no longer the case. Like the leases aren't nearly as appealing now because of the tax credit. And all that depreciation actually means that you can get a really amazing used EV for just like for an amazing deal and one that's not that different. I think you mentioned that you just get a lot more car with a used EV than you do used ICE. And that is very much the case. There's this great research actually from Recurrent that came out a couple months ago. And it lays out that basically, no matter what price point you're at, you are getting a newer, lower mileage car if you buy an EV versus a gas car. And they lay out, so like, for example, $20,000 to $30,000 price range. If you're buying an ICE car, it is an average of a 2021 model year with about 50,000 miles. Same price for an EV, it's a 2022 average model year with only 33,000 miles. So it's like almost 20,000 fewer miles, newer car, and that holds in other price ranges too, which is really interesting to see.
Yeah, and I think, you know, your comment about really not liking the leasing thing, I relate to that. I mentioned in the previous episode about it sort of makes the car feel disposable to me. And, you know, a lot of people in the comments, I think, rightly pointed out, like, well, the car is not disposed of after that. It goes onto the used market, right? That's what we're seeing here. It's you create this big supply, and then that goes out in the real world. I still, my point was more based on the idea of, I don't think we should condition people to the idea that a car is a three-year commitment, because the amount of carbon, the amount of rare materials, just it's a really expensive and difficult process to make a car, and you should commit to a car for a longer time if you can. And obviously, everyone has different choices, and the people who are constantly upgrading are creating this, you know, this supply of used vehicles. But not only are these used vehicles, you know, the used EVs, they're not only cheaper in terms of you get more for your money in terms of, you know, newer car, fewer miles. Also, obviously, you and I know all of the benefits of, you know, smoother acceleration, you know, quieter, nicer technology, all that stuff, right? But there's also this good research from the University of Michigan that used EVs are also the cheapest vehicles to own over a 10-year period when you factor in everything. And I think that obviously makes sense to me when you look at, like, buying a $25,000 used EV, like, how could any ICE car possibly compete with that? Because now, you know, the only advantage that ICE cars really have in the new market is that they tend to be cheaper to purchase. But when you reverse that and they're cheaper, or the EVs are cheaper to purchase, well, you're still paying less in maintenance. You're still paying less in, you know, repairs. You're still paying less in, obviously, fuel. And so, you know, sometimes there's a little bit more in insurance here or there, you know, whatever, or certain vehicles may require repairs. But in the broad average, the study was pretty conclusive that, like, yeah, a used EV is the cheapest car to own. I think it said, oh, a three-year-old electric midsize SUV offers a lifetime savings of $13,000 compared to a new gas-powered midsize SUV. But even comparing like for like, used to used, you're still getting a savings of $3,000, which is not nothing. And again, for an experience that I think we've both driven plenty of EVs to prove, like, it's also just a nicer, better experience, especially in the, you know, mainstream segments. In the luxury segments, there's a little more parity across them. But I always point out that, like, you look at, like, a Chevy Equinox EV versus a gas Chevy Equinox. I mean, just the engine and transmission in, like, a basic American SUV is so much less smooth, compelling, fast than any electric motor. And so I think that's where the real value is it's the mainstream stuff that is just really nice to drive, really cheap to own. And, you know, and again, you're not trading much from a new car.
Yeah. So all of this is contributing to just like a complete boom on the used market. People are recognizing that these are good deals. People are recognizing that there's this great, you know, glut of all these off-lease cars that aren't that old. I think a big part of it also is the battery question. Like, it cuts both ways, right? Part of the reason that these cars are so cheap is because people are not sure about range retention. Like, they don't read the studies. Your average person doesn't know, like, okay, buying a few year old car, is the battery going to be okay? Yeah. And that's what we talked about with Scott Case, co-founder and CEO for Current. We talked about used EV pricing. We talked about what they've learned about batteries and what you should know about batteries if you're thinking about buying a used EV. So here's our conversation with Scott. All right, Scott Case, co-founder and CEO of Recurrent. Thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
This is cool. I mean, I feel like we've been writing about each other's stuff for years now. We refer to you guys, you refer to us. It's great. Very much. Absolutely. I'll say it that way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
totally agreed. So I think just to start out, like, we're seeing a really big boom in used EVs. This is like much different from what we're seeing on the new side, where on the new side of the market, vehicle EV sales are down, stagnating, all that kind of stuff. Used EVs is completely different, where it's growing. It's actually, March was a record month, which was surprising to me. It was more used EVs sold in March than were at the kind of peak of the EV tax credit, like, boom last year. So this is kind of you know, the glimmer of hope, the exciting part of the EV market right now. And I think because of that, we're seeing a lot of people get into used EVs for the first time, looking at these things for the first time. You know, based on recurrence sort of research, what's like, give us the broad scope here. What should people know when they're shopping for a used EV? What should they know about battery degradation? Do these batteries degrade over time? By how much? What can you tell us about that?
Well, first I want to just like stop for a beat on the fact that we are now, this is a record, you know, sort of month, and this is a record trend.
Yeah.
That was on no one's bingo card, you know, September 30th, like of last year, all the rebates run out and that's it, right? Like we're supposed to be in EV apocalypse land right now. And, and then, you know, I think like, you know, I think there's like two things probably happen. One is people realize what a good deal they are. You know, if you have $20,000 to spend on a used car, you know, or $15,000 or $25,000, whatever, and you compare what you can get on a used ICE car versus a used EV, the used EV is a year or two newer. It's got probably 10 to 20,000 fewer miles on it, and it's loaded with a lot more tech. Like, so it's just a better deal. There's no rational sort of like reason why you wouldn't make that choice. But then the second thing is like, since the war in Iran started spiking gas prices, it was like, I think for a lot of people, a lot of normies in my life that are not just like, you know, huge EV people, it just was the straw that broke the camel's back. They're just tired of being subject to the, you know, the ebbs and flows of volatile gasoline pricing.
Yeah.
That, you know, that came out of nowhere for everybody, for all of us. And it's like, so why do you want to be in that anymore? And so I that really feels like what, you know, kind of like what is now breaking through. And then the great thing is like, as you guys know, like once you go electric, you basically don't go back after you've driven it a little while. So this is just like, this just accelerates the conversion, you know? Yeah. So I honestly think like every, you know, like, I can't believe I'm thanking the Trump administration for accelerating the EV transition, but that's exactly what they're doing, you know?
Like, yeah.
Not on my bingo card for this year. Absolutely.
That was something we talked about recently where, you know, people ask me if on a, you know, dollars and cents basis, it makes sense. Oh, should I trade in my gas car for an EV right now because gas prices are too high? And I say, well, you know, when you factor in the cost of switching, you know, you're going to spend a lot of money, the taxes and all that. Maybe it's not the perfect decision in that, you know, frame of reference. But if you want to get off this sort of insane treadmill where you're always at the whim of whatever is going on in the world, right? Like today, the UAE announced they were leaving OPEC, right? And it's like the internal politics of a kingdom on the other side of the world determines what you're paying at the pump in a way that just, it's kind of foolish. It feels like anachronistic because that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we went back for 15 years to look at like, what's the impact of gas prices going up to EV sales? And it turns out there's not actually a very tight correlation there, with the exception of the 2022 period where sort of gas prices went high and stayed high for 6 months during the initial invasion of Ukraine. But what there is a really strong correlation going back is like, going back to the 1970s, every time gas prices go high, new car sales collapse and used car sales boom, right? And so that's just like, so that has nothing to do with EVs versus gas cars. It's just like people don't have as much money to spend. And so, you know, they buy used cars instead of new. And I think that's for 2026, for the first time, there is a really big supply of used electric cars, which are, first of all, cheaper than a new car, and especially because of the tariffs on new cars. And second of all, you know, also, you get off this roller coaster of gas prices.
Right.
So, yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
So, going back to what we were talking about with, you know, what recurrence mission is here and then what the battery concerns are, right? Because that's something I think we've long theorized is driving down used EV prices, right? Is this concern over battery longevity? What do people need to know about degradation rates and failure rates?
All right, so I'm the worst interviewee ever because I'm like taking each question. I'm like, I want to talk about something related to that. But before we get into that, I want to talk about like the three things that I think are causing depreciation, rapid depreciation of like a 3-year-old EV. One of them, I think you're right, is like uncertainty around the battery. So that's why we started our company and just like we thought, God, that market's not working well, and we want to, you know, we want to jump in and support it. But I do think there's two other factors as well besides just that uncertainty. One is, well, I'd say was, you know, until last year, there's a big chunk of money dropped on all new EVs in form of a rebate. And that when you drop $7,500 on a new car, you know, and basically depress the price of the new car, the used equivalent also dropped by $7,500. And so, you know, that now that that's not happening anymore. And it's difficult to imagine that gets restored. Like, I think that actually does lead to less depreciation, you know, moving forward. And then the last one is just like, you know, a new ICE car is basically the same as it was 3 years ago or 5 years ago. There's not a lot of change.
Yeah.
New EVs do continue to just like every model year, they go farther, they charge faster, there's new tech involved. And so I do think there's a meaningful difference. So that does, I think, lead me to believe that there will continue to be faster depreciation, you know, in EVs for some period of time to come than there is in ICE cars. But that means getting back to your question, that used electric cars 3 to 5 years old are an incredible deal.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, yeah, the, a 250 mile car is fine compared to a 275 mile car for a lot of people, or 300 versus 350, or charging speed that's like a little slower, you know, when you do 95% of your charging at home, who cares, you know, kind of thing. So, so I think that just like overall big picture, I don't think anybody should be sitting there going like, I'm worried about EVs depreciating faster when they're thinking about buying a used EV. Yeah, no way. You're taking that loss. Like the person who bought it new is taking the kind of like big depreciation for the first 3 years.
Yeah.
And then you're getting a screaming deal on something that's going to depreciate probably slower than the ICE car does over the following sort of 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, and really the one taking the hit tends to be the captive finance arm, considering half of these were leased as absurdly you know, I was thinking about that when I got my car, of just there were so many incentives on it, plus the tax credit. And it was just like, why would you ever buy a used one or a used EV when the new deals were so great? And now 2 years later, it's completely inverted. It's like, well, now most of the new cars are on sale were new EVs on sale were also available 2 years ago and are coming off lease. And now they're available for 50, 60, 70% off in some cases.
Yeah. All right. Now let's come back to your question.
Yes.
Again, worst interviewee ever. So now that you made the decision to buy a used EV, sort of like what should you be thinking about from a battery and range perspective? So Recurrent, as you guys know, has been around for 6 years, and we've been basically tracking batteries and range across 100 different makes and models of cars. We've now observed over 1 billion miles of charging and driving data, you know, across from 50 to 60,000 individual cars over time. And what I think like has been the biggest surprise for me over, you know, over that period of looking at all that data coming in is, basically, these cars are holding up way better than I expected going into the company. We just released, actually this week, we released our top range retention ranking. Mm-hmm. So basically the models, the manufacturers whose cars retain range best after 3 years. So sort of similar thing to a residual value, which is how much value is retained. Well, how much range is retained. And for a lot of these manufacturers, they are after 3 years, the cars are getting equal or better range than they're still beating their EPA range after 3 years. Like, wow. And that was just not what I thought I was expecting. So cars are like a lot of these cars are beating their EPA ranges at when they're new, and they're still beating their EPA ranges after 3 years, and continuing that trend. Not all of them do, but you know, but I think like a lot of manufacturers were pretty conservative on that front, just to make sure they could deliver something that would continue to have the same utility on year three, year five that it does when it was new.
How much of that would you explain from the perspective of less degradation than we expect versus the car companies building in sort of hidden buffers or not unlocking the full capacity of the cell from the beginning so that your experience degradation is minimal?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really, really important distinction is that we see, like, we think of range degradation or range retention and battery condition as two related but distinct kind of metrics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every, you know, lithium ion battery that's rechargeable is going to have, like, you know, over time lose capacity, right? And that's just, like, that's like physics, you know, that's the way it happens, right? Now they don't you know, degrade like iPhone batteries, for instance, for a lot of different reasons, but it will slowly lose capacity. But the experience and sort of driving range is a completely different thing. And we've like, it's so much so that, you know, I think Recurrent's been known as the battery health company for a long time. And we haven't ever output, you know, battery health percentage. You know, mm-hmm. we use all, everything that we've done so far has been really around range retention. Mm. You know, this car gets 96% of the range that it did when it was new, or, you know, 100% or whatever. And then here's what you get in ideal conditions. Here's what you get in different seasons. Because that's what matters to people. So I think, like, the way then, so that's like, okay, so battery health and you know, range retention are two different things. Why that is, you know, some manufacturers were really aggressive with their EPA kind of like range testing, and because there's EPA range numbers are not like there's a lot of leeway that mm-hmm. the manufacturers have, basically. Most of them are self-testing, right? And they only get audited mm-hmm. every once in a while. And there's, you know, in the rules, there's just a thing where it's like, well, you do all these procedures like this, and then if you feel like it, you can adjust it up by 5%. Literally, that's like what's in there, right? Yeah.
And there's less limitation on what you can adjust down, right? You can claim as low as.
I mean, nobody's ever adjusting it down, but no, but it's like you can just kind of wing it, you know?
I mean, there's a lot of like companies like BMW where you test a BMW EV, it will even on the highway usually exceed its EPA range, or Porsche with the Taycan, famously did this. I'm like, they must be adjusting down. Yeah.
No, most of them do. They're, you know, and so I think they're just not being, they're not being aggressive with them. Some of them are, like, you know, I think it's an open secret that a lot, especially older Teslas, like, they didn't hit their EPA range estimate on day one and in any kind of real world realistic driving. And then they didn't even over time. So they were really aggressive with those. And I think Tesla has actually gotten quite a bit more realistic with their EPA range numbers as in the newer ones. But, you know, early on, it was like we were seeing, I think we weren't the only ones like that. Just drivers were experiencing like, like this says I get 300 miles and I get 220, you know, kind of thing. Like, so I think just interesting sort of strategy on their parts of, you know, where it's like, well, actually, does it matter? Does it really matter if you get 220 miles, you know, and you're supposed to get 275? Like, it turns out people don't really mind if you can charge it anywhere you want. You know, hard to argue with that logic, with the results, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's like this battery nerd set, you know, which I assume a lot of people on who are watching this are in the, like, I want to nerd out and I want to understand cell voltages and cell
are
and balances
nerds?
And all that kind of stuff.
Yes. How dare you?
No, not us, right? I am one of your viewers and I am a nerd, you know? Now, what I think, like, then you know, you have to understand is, like, okay, let's say you go do your Tesla. Have you guys run the Tesla self-test, like the home self-test where you plug your car in and let it discharge?
I haven't myself, no.
So I ran on my Model Y. I call it the Easy Bake Oven test because what you do is you plug it in. You have to wait till it's below 20% state of charge, and then you plug it in at home, and you got to leave it for it discharges the remaining energy in the battery
mm-hmm.
by dissipating heat literally outside the car. So it's like in an enclosed garage, it's basically like it warms up the whole garage as it discharges the remaining energy of the battery. When it gets all the way down to zero, then it charges all the way back up to 100%. And then it's like, well, this is how many kilowatt hours I could jam into that battery, you know? Mm-hmm. And so therefore here's the percentage. So I did it. There were two, I think, hilarious things. One is it matched up exactly with Recurrent's estimate of the battery capacity. Like, you know, we didn't like we weren't asking anybody to sort of take 24 hours of their car plugged in, locked, you know, baking off heat. And the second thing is that, you know, I think that it's just, I think my car came out as a 2023, came out to 93 or 92% state of health, you know, like, all right, well, is that good? Is that bad? I mean, there just wasn't a lot of context. And so I think that for, again, normie people, it's like, well, if you know this is this Model Y 2023 is a 93% state of health, then the second question is, well, how should I think about that? Is mm-hmm. that good or is that bad? Or how much, what's the variance? All the kind of questions. So yep. I think Recurrent is trying to answer that and put it in the proper context. But you know, it's fun. You can do it. It's fun. And there's, you know, if you're a real nerd, you can sign up for, you know, any number of like tracking tools and stuff like that. It's a little harder outside of Tesla, but you know, that's why you would, okay. So yeah, the real nerds here should sign up for Recurrent. It's free. And you get to do that. You basically get that level of analytics on your car without, you know, having to plug it in and leave it dissipating heat in like easy bake oven style. So, there's the real nerds are really like, it's like a 2 to 3% of the general population. So, mm-hmm. We think a lot about how to design for the normies basically, cause that's who's going to be buying these cars, new and used.
Yeah. And so what is the variance then? Like your car, 92-93%, if somebody's out there shopping, like what's the kind of regular range for a car that's a few years old? Is it like between, you know, 85 and 95, or some of them are higher than that, lower than that?
Yeah, I mean, the variance on 3 year old EVs is pretty tight. You know, mm-hmm. it's typically plus or minus a couple of points, right? And it can depend. There's lots of factors of why, you know, it's like, oh, did it get all fast charge? Has it been in the, you know, did it grow up in Phoenix and, you know, get parked outside in the sun and have sort of more heat on the battery over time? Those kinds of questions. Somewhat correlated with odometer, but I think that's like when you have a really, really high odometer relative mm-hmm. to calendar age. It's probably an indication that it had to have been fast charged a lot, like in a rideshare type thing, or else you couldn't have gotten that many miles. You know, you can't, it's difficult to put 40,000 miles on a car in a year, you know, unless you're just fast charging it all the time. So, you know, I think those are all the factors, but it's, you know, typically it's a couple of points variance within sort of 3 years. And then the cone of uncertainty of outcomes sort of widens,
right,
including situations where, you know, there's a battery replacement under warranty. Like it's rare, but like, if you can identify that there's a car that's, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years old that got a battery replacement, like, you know, a year earlier, like, that's an incredible deal, you know, right. and you know, you should definitely look at that and be willing to pay more, you know, for it, because no matter how many miles on the odometer, if it's a brand new battery, like it's going to behave more like a new car from a longevity perspective.
For sure.
So I'd say that's like where like a 3 year old car, you know, it's almost never getting a battery replacement. So it's like that kind of knocks out the potential top end.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you brought up the battery replacement thing, because I want to talk about battery failure, which I think often gets looped in with battery degradation, one of which is an inevitable process and one of which is, you know, a scenario we're trying to avoid. So it appears that like the degradation is slow and it's unlikely to limit the lifetime of the vehicle. But failure, I think for a lot of people is the bigger concern. We see that in a lot of surveys saying that they're really worried about this. In your data, I mean, how likely is it that an EV battery will fail? And then of those that do fail, how likely is that to happen either early in the vehicle's lifetime when it is still under the warranty or after that 8-year, 100,000-mile window? Like what is your likelihood of having an out of warranty failure problem?
Yeah.
Because that's like the nightmare scenario, right? It's like
right,
you hit 8
sure.
years
yeah.
and yeah. then your bat, you know, the battery costs 20 grand and you're screwed.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's two kind of clusters. Again, it's a rare occurrence, right? For sure. But there's two clusters of you know, battery failure sort of moments, right? One is the earliest cars, Gen 1 technology, you know, the first few model years of Leafs and Model S's, right? They have a higher failure rate just because part of it's probably age, right? But also part of the other part of it is just like, you know, there's just, it was just early technology. I mean, like those Tesla Roadsters practically had AA batteries in them, you know, like, you know, but it was like duct taped in, you know, kind of thing. So the technology just wasn't very mature then and has come like every generation, this huge, you know, leaps and bounds. And so the manufacturing quality, all that kind of stuff has really come a long way. And so that, I think that's like, that's a big reason why the cars that are, you know, current to 3 or 4 or 5 years old or, you know, have a really different trajectory than the earliest EVs did. And then the second thing is just like manufacturing kind of like problems. So the Chevy Bolt recall from the 2017 to 2019 Chevy Bolts, like every single one of them was recalled and, right. and replaced or remanufactured. And those ones, you know, I think like they're all happening under warranty. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are just like, frankly, the recalls that have happened with EVs that are related to the battery, sort of like a drop in the bucket compared to the recalls that have happened over the years for ICE cars,
right?
You know, for airbags and for, you know, I don't know, steering wheels falling off and stuff like that, you know. So there, you know, but that all that stuff is getting figured out, you know, well within the warranty period. And so I think that's sort of the second case. So again, here, I think the fear, this is new technology, you know, relative to combustion engine cars. So I think the fear is just way, way overblown compared to the reality of what actually happens.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, Tim, you said this other as well, like that it doesn't cost $20,000 anymore. Like it's, you know, 12 grand, it's 10 grand. Like, and yeah, you know, fair. Over the course of the next sort of like 5 to 7 years, battery costs are coming down so much that if you bought a car today and you're holding it for 10 years and it needs a battery replacement after 200,000 miles, the odds are, what are we in 2036? Like, that's not going to be even a $10,000 replacement anymore. It's going to be like a $4,000 or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like that's still big, but it's like comparable to, you know, replacing major components of, of an ICE car after 200,000 miles.
Yeah. And I think
like
you're
a
right.
That transmission replacement or something like that.
Totally. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fear around it being a new technology, I think, is very real. And when you're talking about recalls, you know, there's multiple incidents recently of, you know, I keep bringing it up, but the GM 6.2 liter V8 recall, where that's an engine design they've been making for a really long time. And it's as simple as an engine can get. And, you know, it is a component deep within the vehicle or deep within the engine that you would never think about or know about until it leaves you stranded. Or Toyota with their new, you know, truck engines also exploding. Like, making an engine that lasts for 200,000 miles requires you to have competency in a million different, you know, subdomains. Whereas if you can just figure out a battery cell, the rest of it is a lot more. It's really once you get the manufacturing down, as we've seen with Tesla or any of these, you can make these packs go a very long way.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing, I think the other difference is that with ICE cars, it happens over time. So it's death by 1,000 paper cuts. Like, you know, I got rid of my Subaru Outback when it needed in the master timing belt replacement the first time at like 90,000 miles. And there was some other stuff that I had to be done, but it was like $4,000 or $5,000, like, was the repair bill that I needed on a car that was worth $8,000. And I was like, no, come on. So that was it.
Yeah, totally. And I guess, I mean, to your point, the with the battery costs coming down, just by virtue of there being, you know, hundreds of thousands more used EVs on the road year after year after year after year, like sourcing that pack, probably it just gets easy if you have,
for sure,
you know, a donor car. It's not like buying the pack from Tesla, which is something that you used to have to do.
Well, and different, this is different for different manufacturers, but like different manufacturers are making it so that the battery pack is more repairable, so you don't have to replace the entire pack. You can replace a module or like 4 or 5 cells, you know, and that brings the cost down quite a bit. There's a little more labor involved in that, but the material costs are way less.
Right. And in the case of the GM EVs, they're also interchangeable. So my Blazer EV, you can get a cell that is also going to be in a Silverado EV. So you really only have that one SKU you have to worry about, which drives everything down. So you have that strategy, and then you have the Tesla strategy, which is still one sealed pack, but there's so many wrecked Model 3s out there that even today, if you wanted to replace a Model 3 battery, as long as you're willing to go with a slightly used battery, you're already paying a lot less than $10,000.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. A lot of those wrecked Model 3s end up in the Ukraine, though, from what I've been reading. So that. It's like, you know, ferrying weapons around the battlefield or something like that. Still attached to their original owner's Tesla app.
Yeah, so as we talked about before, there is this kind of, there's the fear, which, as you say, in a lot of ways, is probably overblown among the general public. Fear of failures, fear of degradation. This does help the depreciation, and it makes it, you know, it makes for great EV deals for people who are willing to go and buy one. How long do you think that window is going to be open? Like, obviously, part of Recurrent's kind of mission is like educating dealers and the public about this, making the, you know, the fixing the market, as you said. Do you think that pretty soon we're going to start to see people recognize that batteries are not a big, you know, big issue, and basically see values kind of more stable as a result?
I mean, I think that for the next, let's say, 10 years, the majority of EV purchases will still be somebody buying their first EV, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah. So I think that just the numbers are that way, you know, like, so I think there's a long period of time where, like, if you're an experienced EV driver, you're sort of gonna be able to surf on that, you know, on that sort of like higher technical level of understanding, technical and just like lived experience. I mean, here's another, you know, thing to think about that I think like a second time EV buyer is more sophisticated in a couple of key ways that give them an advantage over a first time EV buyer. First time EV buyer, like generally speaking, they want 300 miles of range, like forget it, 300, 350, whatever. All the, like the data we're seeing is like the second time EV buyers, like, you know what? 250 is good with me. Like, because they know, they're like, you know, I've had a 300 mile range car, you know, for 3 years, and I've charged it out of the side of the home once, right. You know, like, cause so like, why do I need that much? And so mm-hmm. I think you might see a real big price premium for the 300 mile or the 350 mile car. And as a second time EV buyer, you have a lot more confidence on like where you charge and how often you need to when you're out of the home. And you can basically like get a screaming deal that the first time EV buyer might not see or be willing to do.
Yeah. That's mm-hmm. something we talked about, I think, when we talked about Slate, the concept of selling people 150-mile range EV. And I was saying, I think that's for a fleet customer, it makes sense automatically. But I think that's a car that I could see myself getting because I've owned an EV and I know that I'm not worried about range. But I do think you need that long-range car to convince yourself that, you know, it's just you got to get outside of your comfort zone somehow. And it's like the first time you go camping and you pack, you know, 100 extra little gizmos and things to make sure that everything's careful. And then like the 15th time you do it, you're like, I'm just bring a sleeping bag, a sandwich and wing it. And I think that's something we're going to see a lot over the next 10 years we're going to keep seeing this race towards more and more range. And then eventually when people aren't worried about it anymore, you're going to think about EV range the way we think about gas car range, which is not at all until recently. Well, I started seeing gas cars.
Yeah, you need two things for that to be the case, right? For a 200 mile car range car to be fine. Yep. And one is you know, more confidence and just lived experience, and two is more charging infrastructure for sure. Everywhere, and both those things are changing, right? So yeah, that feels like a I mean, every model year, the average range for the past 5 years, the average range of the entire model year has been going up by like 10 or 15 miles. I wouldn't be surprised to start to see that level off right around 300 average, and then maybe even come down, you know, 5 years from now, start to come down. I have a reservation for a Slate, the small battery pack, like basic, doesn't even have a radio, crank windows, the whole thing. And I'm like, that sounds great to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to let us know. We all have reservations. We'll see who actually pulls the trigger.
We'll see who got in first. That'll be the real question of like, who are the real true EV people.
Yeah. So I'm sure you get asked this a lot in your personal life. Any EV deals in particular that you used EV deals that you have your eye on? Like when somebody comes to you and they're like, hey, Scott, I know you know all about used EVs, what should I buy? What do you tell them?
Yeah. I mean, the ones that I think really stand out in my mind are the 3-year-old used Hyundais and Kias, like, really incredible deals. Maintaining the range really well and just smoking hot of fast charging speeds even 3 from 3 years ago. So that those are going to top my list. My first EV was the Volkswagen ID.4. Absolutely love that car. That had not held its value as well. And doesn't charge super fast and everything like that. But man, like, love that car. They're so cool looking, incredible,
So cheap.
Turning radius. Like, it's just a great car, right? So I would look at that if you're sort of like driving in the city. I don't know. What's your answer to that question?
I think, yeah, EV6s are up there for me. Just I've always liked the styling more than the Hyundai. I Polestar 2s, I think, are awesome deals. I don't know what the long-term support is for those. And then honestly, as I'm getting to the end of my Blazer EV lease, I mean, they're only 2 years old, but they're already sub 25 grand cars. And for me, I'm like, this was a $52,000 car new with every feature you
Just
could
buy it
want,
out.
and it rocks. I mean, the charging speed's atrocious. But yeah, that's sort of what's on my radar. How about you,
Besides
Tim?
that one matter,
Yeah.
What about you,
It's
Tim?
kind of hard. It's kind of hard to find a bad deal, I think about when I'm gonna get in when I'm gonna get a car. My next one, hopefully, is a used Ioniq 5. Maybe Ioniq 6s are probably depreciating even more just because of the sedan. And I look at like the luxury cars. I dream about
Oh,
like a
Lyric.
used, Mercedes EQS or something, which are also not holding their value super well, or like an R1T.
That's actually probably my next one. So we leased an ID Buzz in
Oh,
we
cool.
were must have been
Oh,
one of the first
nice.
couple hundred ID Buzz leases because we got it December 2024,
Oh,
right?
wow.
So it was like really, really early. And so we've got that lease will come up. Great car, so fun. You got to be a huge extrovert though to drive it because everybody wants to talk to you. You know, like all the aging hippies in particular. But that lease will run out December 20, like in a year and a half. And I think probably what we get to replace that, because we do need a lot of like cargo hauling space, would be a 3-year-old R1T. That's probably what we will get
Hell
next.
yeah. Well, we are already over on time, but there's one very important final question I have to ask you then. What color is the ID Buzz?
The blue. We got the white
Ah,
and the
the
blue.
blue, the
Yeah.
blue and
It's
white
the
too. Ah,
best color
it's so
by a
good.
mile.
Yeah, and
By a
just
mile.
I love that they had to tell the dealers, like, hey, if you have any that are one color on the lot, just wrap them because the two tone is the whole game with that car. They look so good.
So this was my story about getting that this car was in the Seattle area where I live. Like, the dealers were just they knew they had, especially early, they were like, we can sell this for anything, right? And so the guys here were like 10, 15,000 above MSRP. They were trying to sort of price gouge early on. I ended up finding a dealer in Pennsylvania who did a deal where I got it for he did it like 2,000 under MSRP. And so I got to I paid to ship it across the country from Pennsylvania to Seattle, and it was still like $10,000 to $12,000 less than anybody here would sell it to me. So it's just wild. Anyway, now you can get
Great
a pretty
stuff.
good deal on that. So well, thank you guys. It was awesome to have the conversation. Happy to do it anytime. I would just say, to all of your viewers, listeners, whatever, a lot of nerds in this crowd. Sign your car up for Recurrence free for the time being. Now that's going to change actually. To sign your car up for current battery monitoring. So get in while you can, and you get all kinds of cool stuff. It's like you get a monthly report on how your car's doing, how it compares to everybody else. You kind of just get that like peace of mind on everything. So yeah, it's fun.
Very cool. Scott, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
For sure. Thanks.
All right. Well, that was a great conversation with Scott. Thanks again for being here on the podcast, Scott. And now with that, we're going to get into our plus and minus. So, Tim, why don't you go first?
I have a plus this week, and it is maybe a controversial one. General Motors announced that Google Gemini is coming to 4 million of its vehicles from the last few model years. I say controversial just because I think there's probably some resistance to AI in everything. Not everybody is down with chatbots still. I think a lot more so than a few years ago when we first started seeing these announcements. Like ChatGPT came out, and then in like fairly short order, you had Volkswagen and Mercedes, maybe some other companies integrate ChatGPT into the car, and so you could ask questions. Yeah. I think these
and
these
notably that was like the last I heard of it. Like I don't ever hear a Volkswagen owner be like, oh, I love that I have ChatGPT. I mean, the only ones I hear talk about it are Tesla owners that have Grok in the car.
Which, but I think, I mean, personally, like I do like using these tools just in my daily life, in my professional life. I ask questions about things. When I was in Japan last week, I didn't have a lot of time to like plan the trip. And I was like, I'm here for 3 days. Like, I want to see, I want this kind of trip. And I asked ChatGPT, like, what are, you know, to plan out like a general itinerary. And like, it's not like a genius level thing, but it's actually quite convenient for certain things like that. So I think that bringing Gemini to the car, to a place where you physically can't like be Googling on your phone if you're in a rush, you want to learn something, I think that's a good thing. And I also think they're bringing some like really interesting features, right? So you can just like talk to it and do research or whatever before a meeting. But also this brings more complicated like navigation type questions where instead of being hyper specific about a place you want to go or like, you know, find me gas stations, you can kind of bounce ideas off of the car and ask more complicated things, which seems genuinely useful.
I think that's the killer app for it, right? Like that's, I think about that a lot where like the main thing I'm trying to do, like why when I'm traveling on a road trip, when I'm trying to find charging, what I want is a charging stop next to a good restaurant. And my fiance has some dietary restrictions. I would like if the restaurant accommodated those. And so like that is the, to me, the killer app of being able to say, find me a charging spot with this type of restaurant next to it. And once they can polish that, I think it's going to be awesome. I also think, I'm the type of person that I feel like I just like to learn about things I see. So sometimes I'm driving through a random town and I'm just like, what's the deal with this town? Like, what is it about? You know, just like a high level, I'm just curious. And that is exciting to me. And my car is part of the 2 million that would get this is a Blazer EV. Will it get it before I return it in July? Probably not. Just based on the cadence of software updates so far, I'm still waiting for the streaming video update that went out to cars over a year ago, some of them. I think this will be really interesting. I think you're going to see definitely some consumer pushback. I like certain parts of using AI. I get frustrated by it being in everything. I know that is especially among car buyers going to be somewhat controversial, but like, I do think there's a lot of real value here of just, it's the place where you can't interact with things outside of your voice. And I think generally AI models are better than other things for dealing with that.
Yeah. And one of the really cool things, this like frankly flew under my radar until I was kind of doing research around this. A few months ago, Google announced that Gemini was going to start to be available in the car via Android Auto, right?
So
you can, if you have an Android phone and you do Android Auto, you can ask Gemini stuff. And they mentioned things like you're driving and you can interact with your Google Calendar, or you can interact with your Gmail and be like, hey, Gemini, I have a hotel reservation in my email somewhere. Like, what's the address and can you route me to that? And like, that's a multi-step thing that's actually like hard to do if you're driving. And the idea that Gemini could do that is I think a big unlock. Or
for sure,
you're on your way to work and like you want, you know, some emails. You want to like summarize a few emails in the morning. I don't have a commute, but like I could see that being another useful thing. So
it'll be interesting to see that it works, which is the big, but
assuming
like
it works.
That's something I had a conversation with the chief engineer of Mercedes GLS and GLE, we're driving around in this prototype and he was like, check out what our new AI assistant can do. Mercedes, open the roller blind on the panoramic moonroof or something. He used interesting terminology, but in my head, it was the specific terminology that the chief engineer would know what to use. And it just completely missed
like three times in a row. And I was like, how do you deal with the fact that we are so conditioned to voice assistants not working? I mean, Siri came out, I think, in 2012, and it still doesn't really work. Like, I still get, you know, I ask it to set a reminder or something, and it just completely whiffs. It's like the most boring and obvious joke in every sitcom now, where someone says, hey, Siri, do this, and then it does something insane. So I think it'll take time for people to warm up, but the people who learn how to use it well, I think, will really enjoy this kind of stuff. And I think, especially with it going to Android Auto, we already know it's coming to Mercedes EVs. We know it's coming to a couple other cars. We know it's coming to all these GM cars. Once it's, I mean, Google, so many of these cars that you think are designing their own infotainment system, whether it's whatever, Polestar, GM, Ford, Hyundai, Kia, they're all using Android Automotive OS underneath, which notably is not the same as Android or Android Auto, totally separate system. So I think this will pretty soon proliferate out, and I'm interested to see how it goes.
Yeah, totally. So what's your plus or minus, Mac?
My plus is kind of in the opposite direction, although it does involve an AI-enabled car. VW released the ID Polo this week, and you know it's going to be their cheapest new EV. Starts at under $30,000 or 30,000 euro, or the equivalent of $30,000 in the euro market. It's not for us. But notably, this is the first car to come out that is starting to steer them back towards the physical control stuff. So a lot less of the capacitive sliders, four window switches instead of two. What a world where you have four switches to control four things.
Wait a second. You're saying four window switches? This is this is revolutionary.
We have the technology. And I think this is just, we're getting to that point when we keep talking about this idea of the generation three EVs coming out. Like, some of it is a technology thing, right? Some of it is we're getting more advanced. But I think a big part of what's going to define this next era is learning those hard lessons from the previous generation of cars and applying them forward. And both VW and Hyundai have been like very explicit saying like physical controls are back. They need to be back. Our customers have made that very clear. You know, we've seen some regulatory scrutiny on this stuff. And I think, you know, it's just, that's what happens when you push too far. Everyone kind of followed the Tesla model of no controls for anything. And I think for a certain very techie type, especially in the luxury and premium space, that's still maybe a move, you know. But I think Polestar, even like the one I'm currently driving, has, you know, the window, or sorry, the air vents, like in a Tesla, are controlled via the touchscreen. And I think that is going to be an anachronism of the 2010s and early 2020s that very quickly is phased out, because Polestar 2 has said we're moving back towards physical controls.
Yeah.
And I think,
I don't know, we'll see. I mean, Tesla has sold a shit ton of cars with that exact thing. And Rivian, I think, is like a pretty smart company when it comes to user interface, and they're doubling down on that too.
I don't love it either. Like, but they have no idea, like, because all of the other stuff, right? When you remove all these switches, you're saving money. And so fundamentally, like, okay, you can be against that or you can be for that. Like, you can argue about whether removing two window switches is like actually saving enough money to be relevant. But fundamentally, the logic like holds. When you look at like, why would you make like vent controls, which are extraordinarily intuitive and very easy to design and cheap relative to having actuators do all of this? There's no, to me, slam dunk benefit. I asked Rivian's design chief about this because I think Rivian does make so many smart decisions. And I was like, why are we doing this? And, you know, he gave me some stuff about, you can have these surprise and delight moments where you program different modes that do this and that, or you have it set automatically so that when you get in the car, it sets the vents to a certain way and I do it the other. And they say that, you know, you don't adjust the vents very often, but I don't know if I'm just a control freak, but I also live in a very sunny climate. Yeah, where whether the sun is physically on you or not, even when the exterior temperature is the same, like fundamentally changes what you want going on. And so I keep having to go into that menu and doing that. And I think the pain point can make sense when you're delivering a clear customer benefit. But in some of these cases, it's like, oh, we're just removing things to make it look cool and satisfy designers or whatever. And I hope this pivot back towards more human-centered design, understanding that we don't want to be navigating 4 points on a, you know, touch display when we're driving 70 miles an hour, is really important.
I think it will last, that revert back will last until the time where we're not worried about us driving or taking our eyes off the road. I think fundamentally you just need to be able to do these things quickly.
The cars just need a thermal imaging camera pointed at your face and body. Right. So when it notices that your forehead is hot and sweaty, it points the air vent at
powered
you.
Powered by AI, of course. Yep. And we'll use the same team that designed the Tesla rain sensing rain sensing windows that saved them that 20 cents or whatever that sensor cost and only has the only taken person. 8 years of development time to still not work.
Hey, it's still in beta. Still in beta, Mac.
We'll get there.
All right. This was fun. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us where you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. And leave us your questions in the comments. Send us an email if you want us to answer any of your EV questions on the show. See you next time.